History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there really are stories there that should not go untold. And they won't go untold as long as people like you and I are willing to take a little time to ask a few questions and, most importantly, to listen to what some of our more experienced Americans have to say. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, we always come out ahead. We're educated, we're entertained, and often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. All of us have just experienced a Christmas unlike any in recent memory. The specter of COVID-19 creating concerns and at times dilemmas that we've never had to deal with before. But interviewing World War II veterans over the last 15 years has helped me understand that so many have gone through so much worse in Christmases past, and I thought we'd pick up a little perspective today from some of their Christmas time experiences in World War II. We're going to start with a man who earned a Purple Heart on Christmas Day, 1944, in Belgium. Philip Houck had survived Omaha Beach on D-Day, but his attempt to celebrate the occasion on Christmas nearly cost him his life. We'll lead into that with his memories from the early stages of the Battle of the Bulge with the 502nd Engineer Company.
One of the reasons that our company was sent in was that we were noted for the fact that we could build a bridge 165 feet long over a ravine, whether it was a canyon or a river or whatever, in less than 3 hours, and have it prepared to take small tanks, trucks, and jeeps. And we could do it 2 a day if we had to, if we had the equipment. Many of them we built at night. Now, they're steel. So remember, at night you don't want to make a lot of noise, because if you do, you could have 88 shells in your hip pocket.
You could have some other steel heading your way.
That's right. So we used leather hammers. Mm-hmm. The hammers were about 3 pounds. And that bridge was so well built that everything just fit. And it was all built by hand.
And for you specifically, in terms of, I mean, I'm assuming every guy had a different job in putting,
yes,
that bridge together that fast. So what was your specific duty? Was it the same every time you did a bridge? Did you have to know a variety of roles? How did that work?
My role was to line up the detonation, set the detonation, make a map to show where the charge could be set from, and then put the charge on the steel as it was going across.
On every single bridge, you had to do that?
Yeah.
Were you ever responsible for detonating it too? Or that?
No, but I've detonated a lot of stuff.
Now, you say that with a wry smile on your face, as if you enjoyed some of those detonations.
I know I speak of Earl Couch a lot, because if you bunk with a guy and sleep in the sand with him and dig a hole and sleep with him and eat with him, talk with him every day, you get to be pretty close. So he was my right-hand man, and I was his left-hand man, I guess. When we were leaving the Ardennes after building this mud bridge, we called it, we left there sometime early morning. It was still dark. And we drove to Liège, and we knew something was on. It had to be the 17th or the 18th, maybe later. Time, we don't know. I don't know. But as daybreak came, there were hundreds of doctors and nurses and patients laying in the streets, still bleeding. The Germans had sent through battalion of their army, all dressed in American uniforms, and they slaughtered everybody that was there.
Mm. So when you saw all those doctors and nurses and you saw all these patients, these wounded soldiers sprawled all over the snow, That was the aftermath of the Malmedy massacre?
That was right, yeah. It was just, they probably were there just a few hours ahead of us because blood doesn't run that long.
That's true. So had you been a few hours different, there's another instance where you would have been slain just like they were.
Oh, sure. But anyway, we left there and I went to Holland. They were afraid the Germans were going to come on through to Antwerp. And we were in Holland, I think, 4 days, blowing up bridges and making it real tough for them to come forward. And then I went back to Liège to help out at the Battle of the Bulge. And that night, Lieutenant White had asked for two volunteers, and he pointed to Earl Couch and me, and he said, you guys see if you can't get some ammo and some blankets into Bastogne. And he said, we'll set you up with some extra gear. So we started out about nightfall and driving with a compass. We got into the first checkpoint. They asked us, of course, the password, and we told them it was Butterfly that night. And we unloaded everything there and then turned and went back. Now, I drove in heading the team, and Earl Couch drove back out. We got out onto one of the highways into Liège, and I'd like to back up a little. My wife had sent me, or my future wife had sent me, a can of Planters peanuts, and we were going to save them for Christmas Day. And Earl Couch, his mother, had baked him a loaf of bread and hadn't finished baking it and put a bottle of Schlitz in the loaf of bread. And so we were saving those for Christmas Day. And we got out onto this little highway, and I could see Earl waving his hand as motion to stop. And so you stop about 200 yards apart, between 100 and 200. And he said, hey, it's Christmas, get the peanuts. And I reached up, picked up the peanuts, turned around, shut the door. And then the next thing I remember, Earl Couch was holding me in his arms. And a lone 88 had hit the bar pit on the right-hand side of this big truck. Apparently, I was close to the tire, front tire, when it happened. And most of the shrapnel that got to me went through everything else. So I only had some small holes in my back, about 18, I think they said. But it had collapsed my right lung. I know I went to Liège because he said, I'm just taking off for Liège with you now. But I never remembered Liège. The next thing I remembered, I was in a padded cell in the hospital in Paris, and this beautiful woman come in, a little nurse. I said, you got me all strapped down here. And she said, yes, and we're going to keep you there until you act like a gentleman. And I said, well, what did I do? And she said, well, you were so bad with battle fatigue, she said, you wouldn't let anybody touch you.
Wow.
So I stayed there for 3 months. And in April the next year, I came home, and I married my wife April the 22nd, 1945.
So you're wounded, you're in the hospital, and thankfully, I guess you don't have any recollections of
how I got there.
How you got there or what it was like, and obviously you were behaving in a way that they found hard to handle.
Yeah.
And that was not uncommon at that time.
No.
A lot of guys dealt with that.
They call it battle fatigue.
We've heard of guys being shell-shocked, and now, of course, we know PTSD.
Yeah.
Is that something that you ever had to deal with again in all the years since?
Once in a while, I have a little problem. Most of my problems are at night. I'm usually wringing wet with sweat.
I know it's not something that's fun to talk about, but it's real. And I've known so many men who have dealt with this for decades after the war. My grandfather was the same way, nightmares for years and years and years.
Yeah.
And I think it's important for the rest of us to realize the price, not only that you paid then, but that you've really paid since then. And it does take a toll on you, doesn't it?
Yeah, I'll have one, I'm sure, tonight.
Thanks to me bringing all this up for you. And I apologize. Well, that makes us all the more appreciative for you and your willingness to talk about all this. And I want to ask about something a little more pleasant. You just kind of referenced it. all that time in the hospital, at some point you remember, hey, there's a girl back home who's going to marry me, and now I got this million-dollar wound. I'm going to go back there, and I'm going to seal the deal. So what was it like when you actually saw her again? Where were you? How'd you meet up?
Well, of course, when Earl took me to Liège, I was put on AWL, or lost in action. So my mother was sent a letter that I was lost in action, or a wire, and she advised Beverly and the family, and they did not hear from me. I think it was in February.
So they didn't know if you were alive or dead?
No. So I wrote to her and told her I was in the hospital, but not to worry. And of course, that's the first thing that they do. As soon as you tell them, don't worry, they worry.
Of course.
But I called her when I got to New York. That was a beautiful sight. I was in a wheelchair, and they wheeled me up on top deck, and we went by the Statue of Liberty. And they had boats shooting water and firecrackers and and 21-gun salutes. And that was a nice time. And I was in New York, and I called my mother, and when she heard my voice, she passed out. So my dad got on the phone, and he said, now, who the hell is this? Here, his wife was laying on the floor. And I said, it's your son, Philip. Of course, he broke up. And so when they got all shook up, I thought, well, I better not call Beverly. I'll send her a wire. So I sent her a wire, and she got it at lunchtime when she came home from work. So she wasn't able to go back to work. I called her that evening, and she said, I'm going to be on the next train. Mm-hmm. She said, I'm coming to New York. And I said, well, don't. She said, well, I want to see you. I'm coming. And I said, no, because they're going to take me to DeWitt General Hospital in Auburn. It was a lung hospital at that time in Auburn, California, and it was closer to my home.
Yeah.
My parents. And I said, why don't you just wait till I get there? And she said, well, you'll have to come through Ogden. Let me come and see you on the train. And I said, well, honey, I don't think they're going to let you close to that train. You know, there'll be guards all over.
Right.
Can't you just wait? She did, finally. Then when I got to DeWitt General, I said, you know, I said, I've been engaged for 3 years, and my future spouse, my wife, wants me to come and see her and to get married. And the doctor said, well, I've met a lot of damn fools in my time. But he said, a man still in the hospital wanting to get married is a little bit out of my reach. But he said, if you think you can make the trip, I'll give you a 10-day pass. They took me down to Sacramento, and I got on a train there, and Beverly came to Ogden from Pocatello.
Ogden, Utah.
Yeah, and uh-huh. and met me in Ogden. I pretty near wore out my kisser, I think. But we've had a wonderful life.
And did you have to go back to the hospital after that?
Oh, yeah, sure. I was still a patient, and so then Beverly and I drove. We didn't have a car, but I had $300. And I bought a 1939 Ford Coupe, V8 Ford Coupe, for $295. It was in pretty good shape for an old car. And we drove to DeWitt General, and I got her a place to stay in town. And I was still on the base, but weekends I could get away, and she'd come out once or twice during the week, and we'd go to a movie or something. And that was in April. In May, I was discharged, the latter part of May.
If that shrapnel had done more than puncture his lung back on Christmas Day in 1944, he would have missed out on 71 years of marriage before his passing 4 years ago at the age of 96. But I want to share just a few more of Mr. Houck's words with you. Remember, he had survived D-Day on Omaha Beach and the entire Normandy campaign before his wounding during the Battle of the Bulge. Here's what he said when I asked him what the rest of us should understand and remember about what he and so many more did so many years ago.
I would like you to remember that had we not won that day, our lives in this country and across the world would very definitely have been different, even to the point that you may have been speaking German today. And to remember that those men gave their lives that we might have freedom. Freedom's not cheap.
No, it surely is not. And as we move from Christmas into the new year, let's make sure that we remember all the men and women who are serving in our armed forces today. It's time for our first break, but when we come back, more Christmas memories from World War II, including two men who, for different yet similar reasons, always cringed when hearing one particular Christmas melody. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
When life throws you curveballs, you have to be adaptable, or at least have a good pinch hitter on the bench who knows how to handle a curve. When it comes to your business, Provident Payments is the best teammate you could ever have. Perhaps it helps that many of the leaders for one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America are former ballplayers. Contactless payments, online ordering, point of sale, you name it, Provident Payments knows it. Now, you could get some of these services from one of the big banking companies, but you're never going to get the kind of personalized service that Provident Payments delivers every day. 24/7 solution-based tech support. When your ability to process payments goes haywire in any way, time is money. So would you rather wait on hold for who knows how long, or would you like to have a direct line you can call for immediate help? That's where a good teammate comes in. Learn more about bringing Provident Payments onto your team at providentpayments.com. They really are one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. That website again, providentpayments.com.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes. Celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, just like the ones I used to know.
That Bing Crosby classic brought hope and sentimentality to servicemen and women around the globe during World War II, but interestingly enough, I've met a couple World War II veterans for whom that melody became a haunting reminder of things they would much rather forget. We're going to get to that, but first, a very pleasant World War II memory in the midst of one of the most bloody and infamous battles in the history of the world. Harmon Atwater earned a Silver Star for his heroics during the Battle of the Bulge with the 26th Infantry Division. With Christmas approaching, he received the occasional incoming shell from the enemy, but also a very special Christmas surprise from Uncle Sam.
That Christmas, we were dug in, the snow was probably 3 and 4 feet deep. And you dig down to find a spot, and the ground was froze down 2 or 3 feet, so there wasn't no way you could dig a foxhole. Christmas Eve, there's nothing going on, nobody's moving, and we're thinking, well, tomorrow will be the same. The Germans were facing the same problems we were having, so there wasn't much fighting going on. And the old sergeant comes by, and he said, we're going to have a Christmas dinner shortly, and we all laughed like you got special K rations, you know. And it wasn't, I guess, around noontime. Here come a Jeep, chains on all four wheels, and a trailer loaded with cans, big containers of food, turkey, mashed potatoes, everything that you need for Christmas dinner. And this is, I mean, really a great treat. It lifted our morale, you know, and God knows it needed it. But what kind of stuck in my mind was there was three men to a Jeep, and they was saying, eat fast, boys. They was wanting to get out of there because they were shelling us, you know. But I thought, well, we'd say, well, stick around, enjoy their meal. And they'd say, well, we got other places to go. Well, they did to other troops. But that was an amazing thing, that we had people thinking behind us that knew that would boost our morale. But can you imagine sitting in snow and ice? At that time, probably 10 below zero. It was quite amazing. Somebody planned way ahead on that.
And 3 weeks later, he would receive his Christmas present. Now, I don't know how many of us would consider being wounded a Christmas present, but Harmon did.
We was in the wooded area, and a shell burst, and a number of men were wounded. When a shell hit the tree burst, plus the shell. So you get a double treatment, and I get hit in the right hand. When the ambulance come to pick up the others that got hit, they took us back to Luxembourg City, Luxembourg. Had a big, large hospital there. And I didn't find out till after I was there a day or so that it was German troops were there, too, that had been wounded. They were in separate rooms, but they were connected. But that was a pleasant stay because I wasn't bedridden, and I had a sore hand for a few days. But I got to add this little ditty. I was laying on my bed the second night there, and I heard the nurses talking, mostly the women nurses. They were talking about midnight they were going for supper. And I brightened up, and I said, well, where do you go for supper? They said, to the kitchen, just down the next floor. And I said, well, they'd feed somebody else that's hungry. And they both said, come on with us. You want to eat? You bet. So I went down with them, and I hadn't had a decent meal. It didn't taste good. Went down to the kitchen, and the old cook comes out, and he said, what do you want, soldier? And I said, man, I said, I'll have me a stack of pancakes. He brought me out about 6 or 8 pancakes, and nurses was laughing, you know. And I ate that, boy, it tastes good. And I'm leaned back in the seat, and my stomach began to boil. And I said, is there a restroom around here? And they said, right there. And I went in there, and I lost the whole thing. But I come back, and they want to know. He said, you all right? And I said, oh, yeah. And the cook come out, and he said, well, can I get you something light? I said, I'll have me another stack of pancakes.
Didn't learn your lesson, or you're just priming the pump, one of the two. Well, and that's a lighthearted story from that stay in the hospital, but that took you off the lines for the rest of the Battle of the Bulge, and what do you think is the significance of that, being off the lines for 20 days?
Well, let me say this. I knew probably 15 guys when I got hit. And I come back on the line in Sarlaten, Germany, right on the Siegfried line. And there was one man that I knew, and he was a cook, Sammy Rikarski. And the rest were all gone. I don't know whether they were killed or wounded, but there was never heard from them again. So I always felt that 20 days off the line probably saved my life.
And his life would touch so many others. That was the late Harmon Atwater from the 26th Infantry Division. The 75th Infantry Division was also involved in the Battle of the Bulge. Sarge Sargentini was with that division. He was tasked with laying communication lines.
It was Christmas. We went into fighting just around Christmas right there. We were in the lines during Christmas. I remember it was just out of Soy that I was in my first blow-up. Somebody stepped on a mine, or what happened, we don't know. But anyway, there were about 8 engineers that were killed that night, you know. So, and before that, our unit had been in combat, and we lost quite a few men. I'll never know just how many, but we knew that we had lost a lot of them. And we stood out in the snow with our dark uniforms. We didn't have camouflage like the Germans did. They had white uniforms, and we didn't. We stood out like stumps out there in the field, in a white field. So we were good targets.
And this is what would become known as the Battle of the Bulge. This is about a week into that, and the 75th was called in as part of that. So you mentioned that incident, and I you know, not to get gory or harp on it, but just so people understand what you went through. So this is at nighttime and pretty close to you. A mine goes off. It kills eight guys.
I was blown up in the same thing, and I suffered a broken pelvis bone at the time, and that was about the extent of my injury on that one right there.
So you must have been pretty close to this mine that went off.
We were. I don't know just how close it was, but I remember the guys laying around, and one of the lieutenants right there, he crawled over and he says, "Are you hurt, soldier?" I said, "No." He says, "I don't think I am, you know, because I was deaf, but I could make him out." And I said, "No, I'm not, because I could move." And he says, "Okay, help me." So we dragged a few carcasses out of the way and took some over to by that time the medics had set up a temporary aid station, and we took some boys over there. So anyway, that was my first taste of real getting into the action.
Well, you say that's your first taste. I mean, that's a smack in the face. And you're describing it. I just want to be clear. So this mine explosion, it knocked you from your feet into the snow?
Yes. It knocked me up against a wall. And I don't know just how I hit the wall, but with my back. And I think it was a sharp box or something, because there was a lot of crates laying around between the wall and the crates. I hit something, and it hit my back end. Anyway, that was my first taste of it, the real action. Before that, it was just running lines. We thought of, you know, we kept looking for relief. They told us we'd be relieved in 3 days. We kept looking for that third day. Well, the third day came, and there was no relief. And then the fourth day, and the fifth day, and the sixth day. And it went on like that. Pretty soon, we just gave up, you know.
Again, I'm just, you know, imagining what this must have been like for you. And this is Christmas time, 1944. So you're only 20 years old. You're out here half a world away from all your family. It's freezing cold. You get blown off your feet into a wall. You can't hear because of the concussion of this mine. And then you just said something, that you guys, in trying to help with the situation, you were dragging carcasses through the snow. Now, those carcasses a minute before were your buddies, guys that you'd been serving with out there. How did you handle the emotions in that moment, or were you just completely numb to it?
They were engineers, and I knew some of them, but you never get real close to another unit. You know, you see them and work with them and like that, but you don't know them very well. And while we were there anyway, after that little deal was over, we were still in the area. It was New Year's Eve, and we opened up with everything that artillery had in the background and the army had in the background. They threw everything they could for a New Year's present to the Germans, and they did. They pounded the heck out of them for a long time, but then the Germans threw some of it back at us, you know, but not as much. Afterwards, back at the CP, somebody had a radio, and they were Bing Crosby was singing White Christmas, and that always got to me, you know, that funny how some things will remind you.
That's not the kind of White Christmas you had in mind. You're out there in the snow in the coldest winter Europe had ever seen, but he says, "I'm dreaming of a white Christmas." You were probably dreaming of coming back home, huh?
Well, I wasn't dreaming of a white Christmas, that's for sure. I knew it wasn't. I was wishing I was home, yes.
And every year, I'm sure you hear that song once or twice during the holiday season. What comes to mind for you when you hear that come on the radio?
I turn it off or I walk away.
It's just too painful for you to remember what you saw?
Well, it brings back a lot of memories, and sometimes, you know, something will... It's just like when I went by the Vietnam Wall, this honor flight. It just does something to you. It just brings... when you see a lot of dead people and you picture them in your mind, you know, you see them, and then to know there was 400,000 guys... I didn't see that many, but I can see people laying all over the snow and like that. I see them get loaded up in trucks after it's all over with, and they're just like cordwood. They threw them in the back end of the trucks and frozen bodies. So it never leaves you. You think back. Some things remind you of it.
And what a powerful reminder to us in two very real ways. One, the scars our veterans return from war with are not always visible, so let's exercise patience and compassion. And two, whatever challenges we're going through this holiday season at home, so many have been through so much worse on our behalf. Believe it or not, Sarge Sargentini is not the only veteran to have told me on this program that Bing Crosby's White Christmas triggered a negative response for him. On the other side of the world from all those soldiers trying to stay warm during the Battle of the Bulge, Mike Wanty was a sailor trying to keep his composure on the destroyer USS Lardner, a ship that earned the nickname the Lucky Lardner for all the close calls it had made it through in the Pacific. Are there some times that you look back on when you were on the Lardner and you remember what happened and you can picture it in your mind and you ask yourself, how did I survive that? Or maybe say, well, hey, I was pretty fortunate to survive that.
There is one, and I don't like to talk about it. And if I do tell you, I may crack in talking about it, but I'll tell you, it happened at Christmas time. This is why I hate Christmas.
Still today, 70 years later, you hate Christmas.
In a way, I don't know if I can tell you or not. It happened at Bougainville. We helped the Marines go ashore, and then the bodies started coming back, and they would come back in baskets. And one of the, you shouldn't have done this. This boy, they put on the wardroom table. He had no arms, no legs, and he was burned over most of his body. And all we could do was give him morphine, and he wanted to hear White Christmas. All the time, it was a record to play over and over and over and over. And it took us about 10 hours, I guess, to get to a forward hospital on Vella La Vella. And the doctor said to me, he says, I won't let him die, Mike. I'll get him ashore. And he did, but he died once he got there. But he didn't die on the ship. I've always felt bad. I never got his name. Or his father and mother. I've always wanted to write to her. He was about 17, Marine, nice young guy.
It's okay. I'm sorry, Mike.
You don't realize. I happens if I ever think about it. And at Christmas time, it's double. They keep playing White Christmas. I've gotten used to it. But to talk about it, it's different.
But over the years, if you're somewhere and White Christmas comes
you
on,
you never can forget it.
You said your whole life you've wished you had gotten his name so you could have written his mother. What do you think you would have written to his mother? What would you have told her?
That he was brave and he thought of his family. He was a farm boy. I think from Ohio, I don't know. But I've always regretted that I didn't get his name and address.
Mike Wanty passed away in 2018. Perhaps that connection with that brave young Marine that never occurred in this life has taken place in the next. It's break time again, but still to come, three men who all experienced Christmas in captivity. And unlike White Christmas for Sarge Sargentini and Mike Wanty, we'll hear about one Christmas carol that evokes a very special memory for an ex-prisoner of war. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. As you wind down from Christmas 2020, as you write all those thank you notes and clean things up and try to look forward to what 2021 might hold, we are looking back to Christmas's past and some of the things our World War II veterans went through. Years ago, we met Leonard Cosby on this program, and so many of you send in your accounts of when and where you met Leonard. The podcast of his episode is one of the most frequently accessed at hometownheroesradio.com, but we're going to hear just a little piece of his story today. And maybe think about what you were doing this Christmas Eve as we hear about what he experienced on Christmas Eve 1944, when, as part of the 80th Infantry Division, he was manning a roadblock on the perimeter of the Battle of the Bulge.
Some German soldiers sneaked up and started shooting at us. They couldn't get a direct shot into where we were, so they were shooting at an angle. And on our right side was a wooden, kind of like a garage where they had parked something inside the garage. This German was shooting at us. They had some tracer bullets in with their ammunition, and the tracer bullet would hit the side of this wooden garage and stick there and fry. They didn't last long, just a few seconds, and they went out. That was the only time they came up there attempting to shoot us or shoot at us. And to this day, I can't understand why they didn't throw a hand grenade or something in there at us.
You're not complaining that they didn't?
Oh, no. No, fortunately, I made it through it in fine shape.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's additional vehicles coming up the road, so we had two bazooka shells. We had already used one, so now it's time to use the other one. And I moved up on the ridge and loaded the bazooka gun and fired it. And when a bazooka shell hits metal, out the other side of the metal will be flying molting metal. And when I fired the bazooka gun, I could hear some German soldiers down there screaming and hollering. And after that, we didn't hear much of anything from them. There was no firing at us or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that must have been about, maybe 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning.
And how many people are with you here?
There's three of us in that roadblock.
Three of us. So this is not a well-fortified position. You don't have a lot of reinforcements. You guys are out there on your own.
Right. And there's really not much of anything around us to protect us either.
And you have no idea how many Germans are out there?
No.
So it's 3 a.m.
And one of the fellows became excited. And I guess he was a little bit hysterical. He said, we're going to have to do something. It's going to be daylight here before you know it. And when it gets light, the Germans are going to come in here and kill us all. He said, we're going to have to give up. And I said, that might be all right. But I said, who's going to walk out in the middle of the road to give up?
Mm-hmm.
And I was standing down near the front of our position there, and this guy just pushed me right out in the middle of the road. So I started yelling, comrade, comrade.
And this is about daybreak or what?
Well, I'd say it's about 3 o'clock or 3:30 in the morning.
So you didn't want to wait till the sun came up?
No.
Mm-hmm.
No, he was afraid that they would come in there and tear us to pieces.
Mm-hmm.
So fortunately, I don't know why the Germans didn't start shooting, but they took all three of us as prisoners and took us down to a German officer who questioned us as to what organization we were in, what unit we were in, and how long we had been there.
Not very long.
No.
Didn't have much to tell them, did you? Not that you would have anyway.
No, but I'm sure they knew the organization we were in, what division and all.
Emotionally, what was that like? Because here you have put in all this time and training, not to mention your brother going in with you, and you're going over there to win a war. And now all of a sudden, you've had this intense experience where you didn't know if you were going to die, and here you are surrendering, not knowing what the future holds. That seems like an awful lot to try to process in a 19-year-old brain.
Well,
I didn't know what to expect from the Germans or where they would take us, but they had us marching for a ways, and then they put us on a trucks and hauled us back into Germany.
Leonard Cosby, one of the dozens of ex-prisoners of war we've met on Hometown Heroes over the years, and one of many to have spent Christmas in captivity. No division had more men experience Christmas in captivity than the 106th Infantry Division, which had two of its three regiments overrun and surrounded at the start of the Battle of the Bulge. Mac McMullen was one of more than 6,000 of those golden lions of the 106th to be part of one of the largest mass surrenders in history.
We were captured late in the evening and marched down the hill. And they got a little town called Belief, B-E-L-I-E-F or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
They congregated us there, put us in column and so many abreast and started down there. Didn't stay abreast very long. It was just mass. You see on the movies, you know, confusion.
And was there talk among your ranks of guys trying to go out on their own, make a break for it, avoid capture and captivity?
Not at that point. We weren't sure. We didn't know what we were doing. We mm-hmm. were just surrounded. That's the night I got my feet wet. I got both feet wet, and I didn't have combat boots because they didn't have my size. So I got the regular shoe, and I tried to go through a little stream where you jump across. I got both feet wet, got them frozen. Mm-hmm. And later on, as things went on, because we walked that particular time, we walked from the middle of that afternoon, all that night, all the next day, and then before we stopped. And by the time we got there, my feet were frozen, and I was at the point where I couldn't make it anymore. And this is when I went to church and Sunday school and all that, but I was one of these guys that prayed for a bicycle or something like that. And I was holding back saving that, I guess. I didn't know it. But I prayed that just give me one more half mile. Just give me one more half mile. And then I got to where I was getting ready to drop out. And somebody I don't know, never saw him before. I've never seen him since. He was a big guy. He grabbed me by, put me on his shoulder or arm, and he helped me. And with him and some other help, I got there through the night and the next day. But that was tough because I couldn't. I was ready to drop out. I just couldn't go anymore.
And for our listeners, tell us what that would have meant if you would have dropped out. You would have been left for dead, or maybe
they might shoot me, or mm-hmm. to make sure I wasn't playing games with them, and so that they didn't. No, they didn't. I'd have frozen. My feet were already frozen. I couldn't go anywhere.
You know? So you thought that was it?
Yep, that was as close as I've ever come.
And a desperate prayer was answered, and a big, strapping fellow American who.
Right.
And who knows? Who knows who he was, huh?
No, I don't know. Never saw him. It was in the middle of the night, and I didn't ask him. He saw me stumbling and heading for the edge of the column, and grabbed me and says, "Hang in there." And we, the two of us, stumbled along. You've seen it in the movies, and that's the way it is.
And I've had so many prisoners of war repeat to me the POW motto of "we help those who can't help themselves." And there was someone who helped mm-hmm. you when you couldn't help yourself. How many times over the years have you thought back to that when someone needed help from you?
I've been there.
Mm-hmm. And I can tell it's still powerful for you, and I certainly understand why. So you made it through that night.
We wept all that night, and then the next day, and then they finally let us stop, give us a rest. Some of us were in a schoolhouse, some of us were in a church, a barn, whatever, because there wasn't any facilities. It was just where you could flop.
Mm-hmm.
And we spent that night there. And then the next day, we were in a little town called Gerolstein, Gerolstein, something like that. And mm-hmm. they loaded us on boxcars at that time.
And this is the famous 40 and 8.
Mm-hmm.
40 people or 8 horses, but I'm sure they stuck a lot more than 40 in there.
60.
Uh-huh.
You couldn't, you, what you did, you sat down with your knees up, and then the guy got behind you and his back to yours were the same. And if you got into that position, everybody got in that position, you could all sit down at one time. Otherwise, you couldn't.
And you probably needed that for some body heat, too, right?
The heat came from the manure that was in the boxcar. There was about 8-10 inches of manure in the boxcar. And us city boys didn't know how many BTUs there were on a pound of horse manure. But it was because the next day, a couple guys, when they would let us out to relieve ourselves. And,
sure.
And there was no water, so we'd be eating some snow. And a couple of them asked if they could shovel this stuff out, the manure out. Well, man, when you, that part where the car, where these jokers got rid of the manure, was frozen just like the...
Never thought you'd be wishing for horse manure,
no,
huh?
No.
And this sounds like a miserable existence. I mean, certainly the uncertainty could eat you alive, if not the freezing temperatures and just the agony of really not having any sustenance.
We hadn't eaten. When we got captured, we hadn't eaten for 2 days. They just had to bring the chow up to us because when we were by ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Jeep didn't get there for 2 days before we were captured. Mm-hmm. So we still didn't have anything to eat until, well, I guess it would be the second day. They give us a loaf of bread for 5 guys, one of their brown breads that they make out of
sawdust. Tree flour.
Yeah.
So if you ever think one of those infamous Christmas fruitcakes is hard to stomach, imagine all those prisoners of war eating sawdust-filled bread for their Christmas dinners during World War II. We have one more veteran for you to hear from today, a man whose story we featured just last month on Hometown Heroes, but a Christmas memory that I have thought of every time since when I've heard the song Silent Night. Don Cooley was another one of those 106th Infantry Division soldiers captured in the early days of the Battle of the Bulge. He would spend Christmas and his birthday in one of those infamous 40 and 8 boxcars used to transport prisoners.
My job is a battalion clerk. I happen to have in my pocket another blank sheet called a morning report where you list the names of everybody. And so I passed this thing around the boxcar and had everyone sign it that was in there. I think there were 60 of us then. The third day we were strafed because the boxcars were not labeled, and these were, we think, British plays. So they opened the doors and we got out to dive in the ditch. Yeah, it was cold by then. But the point I want to make is that they did run along this train, long train, and open up the doors when the strafing occurred. The trouble is, strafing's over before they could get to 2 or 3 cars.
And when you say these boxcars aren't labeled, what you're saying is if they had said POW on the top.
Red Cross. Yeah.
Then the planes would have known not to shoot.
That's right.
But they don't know.
They don't know.
And so you guys are helpless inside this boxcar, and if they don't open the doors, you're going to have a lot of guys die.
That's right, or you hope that pilot is a bad shot. Some guys took off at that point and didn't come back to the boxcar.
Did you think about trying that?
Not a bit.
Why not?
Well, I think it was because if I had thought about it, I think I would have nixed it because I think it was the fourth day into Germany, the third or fourth. That's a pretty long way to get back through the lines.
So you knew.
And no food.
And wherever you're going to be, it's German-held territory. So the likelihood of you getting through all that and back to American territory is rough. And are you getting pretty hungry by now?
Yes.
Are you getting scared?
No, I don't think so. We were with friends. That helped so much.
Well, and you said you celebrated your 21st birthday in a boxcar. I don't think that's how most young men imagine spending their 21st birthday.
Well, I wouldn't interview very many people with that question, but I think I know the answer, so I don't need to.
Did it occur to you that it was your birthday? Did you mark the occasion?
Oh, sure. The day after Christmas.
Well, I guess I should ask you about Christmas, too, then, huh?
Well, there was a significant thing. We started singing Christmas carols in the boxcar. And I get emotional about that. There was another fellow among our group, had a good voice and knew the words. But pretty soon other people chimed in. And the irony, of course, is that that's a German carol, Silent Night.
So you're somewhere in Germany, you're prisoners in a boxcar, freezing and starving.
Well, we weren't freezing in there. From that standpoint, we were better off than the soldiers that didn't get caught. It got down to the coldest winter to date there in Germany, and we were sheltered. And that was something to be thankful for.
But here you are, 60 GIs, singing Silent Night inside a boxcar?
Yeah. Well, it was Christmas.
How did it sound?
They didn't sing happy birthday to me the next day, but I don't think I told them anyway. They might have. You know, what do you do? You're just there all day sitting on your duff and chatting. Because we were in that boxcar for 9 days.
Well, and I imagine you've probably heard Silent Night hundreds of times in the 75 years since then.
Sure. Wonderful song.
Can you listen to it now without thinking of that boxcar on Christmas 1944?
No.
And what do you think about when your mind goes back to that moment with those
guys? Oh, I cloud up.
You might be the only one from that boxcar who's still here.
It's very possible.
I'm not trying to put words in your mouth or make it more than it was, but I can sense just from your description and your emotion that this was a real powerful moment for you.
Oh, yes.
What did it do for you?
Made me feel better, probably.
Gave you a little sliver
and
of hope.
And also, it was another bond with the others who were singing with us, which we needed at that time.
They definitely needed that at that time, and maybe some of us could use something like that at this time. Earlier, we talked about Bing Crosby's White Christmas and what it turned into for two heavy-hearted veterans. We're going to wrap up this special edition of Hometown Heroes with another Bing Crosby record. As we look forward with hope to 2021, we can also pray for the peace reflected in the last lines of that 200-year-old carol, Silent Night.
Sleep in heavenly peace. Sleep in heavenly peace.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.